This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega.
We all should be able to agree that in the United States of America, we will not intentionally separate children from their parents. We will not do that. We are better than that.
That is the unmistakable voice of the late Congressman Elijah Cummings, speaking in 2018 during a meeting of the House Oversight Committee, convened to discuss the Trump-era policy of separating minor children from their families at the southern border. And as a civil rights activist and the son of sharecroppers, I suspect the late Representative Cummings knew that his assertion of America being, quote,
better than that,
was more aspirational than factual. Indeed, our national history is replete with examples of willful separation of children from their parents.
I was sold first to Ben Davis, a slave trader, and my daughter was sold to a stranger. I fell on my knees before Mr. Davis and begged him to buy my daughter from this stranger. His heart must have been touched by my agony because he walked over to the stranger and offered to buy my patience. But the stranger refused to sell her. And he went away a few hours later. I have never seen my daughter since.
That's the voice of a young actor performing a true story as part of a program titled Last Scene, which was staged in February 2019 by Villanova University's Departments of History and Theater. She's reading one of the thousands of information wanted ads taken out by formerly enslaved people who were forcibly separated from their families during American slavery. These ads show that even decades after families were scattered by the sale of human beings as chattel, people still wondered about, yearned for, and searched for their loved ones. In 1941, Nikki Nojima Lewis saw her father arrested by FBI agents during her fourth birthday party. He was guilty only of being a Japanese immigrant. And after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, tens of thousands of Japanese American families were separated and incarcerated across the American West. Nikki Nojima Lewis spoke about her experience in a 2019 interview with New Mexico Public Television.
You know, I've had a childhood in camp. My father was taken away and I was with my mother in a concentration camp in Minidoka, Idaho, in the desert of Minidoka, Idaho, one of 10 war relocation authority camps.
19th century separation of enslaved families, 20th century separation of Japanese American families, 21st century separation of migrant families. All rest on a brutal government practice which for more than a century forcibly removed hundreds of thousands of indigenous children from their parents, families, and tribes in both the U.S. and Canada. These children were taken to so-called boarding schools to be stripped of their language, culture, traditions, and identities through a policy of forced assimilation. And like the newly emancipated who took out newspaper ads for their loved ones, the families and communities of these Indigenous children have never ceased yearning and searching. Last week, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced a new initiative to investigate the, quote, loss of human life and the lasting consequences of this practice of family separation.
I know that this process will be long and difficult. I know that this process will be painful. It won't undo the heartbreak and loss that so many of us feel. But only by acknowledging the past can we work toward a future that we're all proud to embrace.
That was Secretary Haaland addressing a virtual conference of the National Congress of American Indians last week. The U.S. government's announcement follows similar efforts in Canada, which resulted in the discovery of the remains of 215 Indigenous children buried outside a boarding school in British Columbia, as reported in late May. And in recent days, another 751 unmarked graves were found near the site of a former school in Saskatchewan. Overall, an estimated 6,000 children died at schools in Canada. And according to government officials, many of the children were physically and sexually abused. If we are to be
better than that,
as Representative Cummings believed we could be, then we must begin by facing and addressing what happened here. And we begin here with Nick Martin, staff writer for The New Republic and member of the Saponi tribe. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Talk to me about why. Why are we now seeing an initiative like this in the U.S.?
Well, I think there are probably a couple of reasons as to why this moment. First and foremost being that Deb Haaland is the Secretary of the Interior. Deb Haaland is a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo and is the first Native official to be appointed to a cabinet position in United States history. I mean, so her presence in the interior, which oversaw many and funded many of these schools, cannot be overstated. And I wrote in a column this past week in the New Republic, kind of pointing this out, both as a measure and a testament to Secretary Haaland's obviously overwhelming support for tribal consultation and listening to what tribal communities need, but it is also an indictment of, I think, every interior official who came before her in a leading position that chose not to take similar action. This is something, as you mentioned, Canada has kind of undergone this already with their Truth and Reconciliation Committee from 2008 to 2015. They're a little bit ahead of the ball on this. We're just starting. So it's going to be a long road, but I think Deb Haaland's presence is first and foremost why we're seeing this happen. In addition, I think the political news around the recent discoveries, both in Canada as well as in the U.S., you're talking close to or over 1,000 Indigenous children's remains being found within a month. So I think that also obviously maybe spurred to action plans that were already in place. I think those are kind of the news in addition to Secretary Haaland's position, I think are the main reasons we're seeing so much action on this right now.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of these boarding schools, how they came to be, maybe beginning with the Civilization Fund Act of 1819?
You have to frame it within the broader context of colonization in the United States. Much of the efforts of colonization were a little bit more disparate to start and weren't quite as organized. So what you saw, a lot of the conditions that we can maybe get into here in a second, were kind of formed more in these missions that would be run, church run, or in these forts, which would be a combination of church and whatever European government, or eventually would turn into the American government being run. And the idea behind these missions and forts were varied, but the overarching design for those was to kind of slowly begin to extract the culture and the language from Indigenous people and assimilate them. But it wasn't done in quite an industrialized fashion because Indigenous nations remained very strong Indigenous nations, which they do today as well. I think the problem was that after westward expansion, kind of through the mid-19th century, the United States started really taking a hard look at they actively wanted to remove tribal nations as political entities. And as many colonizing forces have done over the years, they recognize that the fastest way to that is to go through the children. And so you started with the first, kind of official federally run boarding school being the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, which operated, 1879 to 1918. And then that kind of kicked off a much larger expeditious trend by the United States government, and Canada was also doing its thing at the same time. And ultimately by the end of it, I think we had close to over 350 boarding schools by this time it was said and done in the 1980s and 1990s when they finally transitioned fully into these current Bureau of Indian Education schools that are still operating today.
Pause. They're still operating today.
Yeah. So when I say that, I don't mean that they're operating in the same function, but many of the same exact school grounds and school facilities have been repurposed by the Bureau of Indian Education, which by, you know, treaty and trust responsibility, along with things like the Indian Health Service, you know, it is one function of the federal government to provide education for tribal communities.
So talk to me just a bit about what the experience was like for children in these schools under that sort of more oppressive regime that we've just been talking about.
Yeah. And I want to be really careful here. We are talking about things that happened in the 19th century, but these also happen. There are people alive today who went through these schools, who live with, you know, active scarring emotionally, spiritually, physically, because of the conditions at these schools. So, you know, I don't want to be overly gratuitous or anything disrespectful towards those experiences. And I think this is maybe more of a meta commentary than anything, but I do think that, you know, like I said earlier, Canada is probably over a decade ahead of us on this. And just in terms of trying to build some sort of public acknowledgement of just how horrific these schools were for the children that were forced to go there. And you're talking in the thousands, tens of thousands. And it was very mechanical. And that's where I get when I'm faced with a question of describe what happened there. I foresee over the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be lots of opportunities, I think, for living survivors to mm-hmm. tell their stories in more prominent ways and be given the platforms that they deserve. These were places where the children's well-being was the absolute last thought on the list. These were not schools. They could even call them, mm-hmm. like, we use this term, and Canada uses residential schools, we call them boarding schools. The problem that we're going to face over the coming years, I think, and this is something we face a lot with just, you know, basic, I think, language impediments, which is that if you talk to most Americans and you ask them about boarding schools, and you just left it at that, their mind is going to some Northeastern prep school to feed into an Ivy League mm-hmm. or something like that. And if you ask any Indigenous person, like, you're getting a completely different reaction. So I think that terminology, you know, boarding school is so light as to what happened there. I mean, these are places where children were literally sold out for free labor to nearby farms and factories, where they were, you know, had their hair cut, they had their language stripped from their mouths, or they were physically reprimanded. Like, these were things, and much, much worse. I think that we're going to, you know, just as I kind of take a step out of my body here and look from 30,000 feet, I do think, you know, as we move forward and we try to get into facing the truth of what happened at these schools, we're also going to have to face the truth of how to communicate that to a public that just doesn't have a clue of the recency of it, but also to the extent of how, like, designed it was to do its specific function, which was not be a school. It was to be a place of assimilation and cultural genocide. And those are really, you know, I mean, especially genocide is a strong word, but that is what this is a part of. This is how you politically erase a people. And that is what the mission was. And so I think as we get into discussing the conditions, the terms, the history of it, we also have to keep in mind that it is a present history, and just be cognizant that, you know, someone out there might be listening, went through this experience, and I just want to be respectful of them and anybody else who does these kind of, you know, subsequent media coverage, as they should. And I'm so thankful that y'all are doing it. I just hope that everybody can kind of keep that in mind.
What is this review going to entail?
So it's broken down into several phases. And again, we're functioning off of a 3-page document at the current moment. So I think we'll get much more kind of details as to what a full-throated review will consist of in the coming months. But essentially their goal is to really create a full database of information from survivors, from tribal nations, from these boarding schools. So much of the information that was out there regarding enrollment regarding whose child was sent where. I mean, that is information that is largely, you know, out in the ether. I mean, there's no kind of unified sense of being able to connect, because right now we're, like I mentioned earlier, Carlisle Industrial Indian School, it is in the process of disinterring the remains of children who died and were buried in its graveyard. And which, you know, the school, many of these schools had dedicated graveyards because of just how many children they would lose. And, or I guess rather, you know, I think you could go as strong as say kill. And the idea here for the interior is to really kind of connect and unify all of this information that is out there in a way that allows, I think, some grieving and some closure to be found for families, both in terms of having the remains either be returned or be set in a way that is more respectful of their spirits and their families. I think also the idea is to allow tribal nations to really lead the way on what is appropriate here. So you're going to be featuring lots of talks between interior officials and you know, appropriate tribal government officials over the coming months in terms of how do we actually set forth a series of goals or recommendations or policies that the federal government or the state government or the tribal government need to undertake in order to, I think, one, be able to rectify, or not even rectify the situation, but just be able to reach some sense of justice, I think. And right now, these are like kind of vaguer terms that I'm using because we're not quite sure what the endpoint of this review is going to be. It's going to be produced by April of next year. But beyond that, you know, the details of what it actually include, we can kind of only, you know, infer based on what Canada has done, and then also just kind of look at what the available options for the interior are to do within a year. Because a year is not a very long time to, I think, put together this information. I think it'll ultimately end up being a much larger, longer project.
So you've talked a couple of times about us being sort of a decade behind Canada, also sort of pushed by Canada and some of the recent findings there. How is the Canadian process different than the process that the U.S. seems to be embarking on here?
I think it was, part of the problem that, you know, Indigenous people face in the United States is oftentimes, you know, a numbers game. And the truth is that, you know, in the Indigenous populations in Canada are just a much higher percentage. And so their ability to bring public awareness to this issue, you know, just came about, I think, just on a faster time scale, as well as, you know, their ability to then influence. You had people like Murray Sinclair and these people who are actually, you know, senators and sitting members of the federal government, which, you know, I mean, when Deb Holland left the House to take over the Secretary of Interior's role, our number of Native people in Congress went, I think, from like five to four, but then we got two more in the House this year. So it did kind of end up balancing out. But my point being that it's very low. And so the ability to kind of do what is necessary in those, you know, committees and subcommittees and use them as kind of platforms to bring to light issues that, you know, for Indigenous people have never been brought to light fully. It has not really been there for us in the U.S. And so, and this is also a testament to the organizing and hard work of not just government officials in Canada, but all, I think, of their, like, the Indigenous governments and communities have worked like supremely hard to ensure that Canadians of all stripes recognize what happened at these places. And that's what's happening with Secretary Holland and her team at the interior now. You work with what you have. And right now, you know, in a sense, we have the interior. We have this massive federal agency with somebody on top of it who truly cares. So I think that you have to leverage that moment. And that is also why you're seeing this boarding school initiative, because it's something, like I said earlier, like, we're long overdue for this, and I think Secretary Holland recognizes that as well.
Nick Martin is a staff writer for The New Republic and a member of the Saponi tribe. Nick has reminded us today that history matters, language matters, and representation matters. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.